This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Iraq's parliament is reacting to the civil unrest in Basra by calling an emergency meeting. Reuters' Rosanna Philpott has more.
Unrest mounted in Iraq's Basra overnight as protesters stormed the Iranian consulate on Friday, chanting, "Iran, get out." Demonstrators broke in and began damaging offices and ransacked and set alight government buildings in mounting anger of what many Iraqis perceive as Iran's sway of the country's political parties. It was a calmer scene on Saturday morning, despite Iraqi security sources saying three rockets had hit Basra's airport. But an official denied those reports, saying there was no disruption.
That's Reuters' Rosanna Philpott. Iran has executed three Iranian Kurdish activists who have been operating in that country. The Iran Human Rights Group is condemning those executions. The Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, must be held accountable, it says. In a video message recorded on Friday and sent exclusively to VOA's Persian service, the mother of one of the jailed men and a brother of the other issued a joint appeal to the international community to stop Iran from carrying out the imminent executions of all three men. 11 people were killed Saturday in an aerial attack by Iranian forces on the headquarters of the Iranian opposition Kurdish Democratic Party in a refugee camp in Iraqi town of Koya. The director of the city's hospital confirmed the attack and the casualties. The U.S. House of Representatives has passed a bill that would make it easier for the federal government to deport immigrants who have committed violent crimes. The legislation clarifies what constitutes a violent crime, addressing an issue, a previous law that the Supreme Court ruled this year was too vague. Previous law required the government to deport a non-citizen who had engaged in a crime of violence. This is VOA News. China's trade surplus with the United States reached a record $31 billion in August. That's despite hefty tariffs recently imposed on Chinese goods. The news of the surplus came just hours after U.S. President Trump threatened to impose another $267 billion worth of tariffs on Chinese imports, which would cover virtually all the goods China imports to the United States. The potential tariffs would come on top of punitive levies on $50 billion in Chinese goods already in place, as well as another $200 billion that Mr. Trump says could take place very soon. He told reporters traveling with him to Fargo, North Dakota, "Behind that, there's another $267 billion ready to go on short notice if I want." Such a move would subject virtually all U.S. imports from China to new duties. The U.S. Trade Representative's office received nearly 6,000 comments during 7 days of public hearings on the proposal. And the Trump administration's argued the tariffs on Chinese goods would force China to trade on more favorable terms with the United States. Former U.S. President Barack Obama, who has maintained a low public profile since leaving office, has entered the midterm election battle with this simple message.
A glance at recent headlines should tell you that this moment really is different. The stakes really are higher. The consequences of any of us sitting on the sidelines are more dire.
Mr. Obama said everyone must vote in November because democracy depends on it. President Trump was dismissive of President Obama's speech by comparing his economic accomplishments with those of the former president.
I have to say this to President Obama, and it wasn't him, but would have been the same thing. If the Democrats got in with their agenda in November of almost 2 years ago, instead of having 4.2 up, I believe, honestly, you'd have 4.2 down. You'd be negative. You'd be in negative numbers right now. You'd be in negative numbers. We were heading south.
The midterm election will be November 6th and is widely seen as a referendum on the Trump presidency. George Papadopoulos, the Trump campaign advisor who triggered the Russia investigation, has been sentenced to 14 days in prison Friday by a judge who said he had placed his own interests above those of the country. Thomas Breen is his lawyer.
I think it is really stupid to lie to the FBI, especially when you don't need to speak to them. So I think most people who would read about this sentence would begin to educate themselves that they don't want to do 14 days because they lied to the FBI. I think it does send a message.
Papadopoulos is the first Trump campaign aide sentenced in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's ongoing Russia investigation. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
His legacy is full of negative aspects such as nepotism, corruption, stealing the money of the people, all those things.
Former Angolan President Eduardo dos Santos steps down as leader of the ruling party, the MPLA.
You know, we cannot allow to defeat and to rape democracy. We've been in the country for a number of years in democracy since 1994. Since 1993-94, we'd like to make our democracy mature. And this is what the United Transformation Movement will be doing.
Malawian Opposition United Transformation Movement campaigns Saturday in Zomba.
Most Zimbabweans are now preparing themselves for the five-year tenure, and they're wondering how best they can get on with their lives to make sure that they are comfortable in the next coming 5 years.
And former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe accepts the election victory of Emmerson Mnangagwa in the recent presidential vote. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Former Angolan President José Eduardo dos Santos officially hands over control of the ruling People's Movement for the Liberation of Angola, or MPLA party, to President João Lourenço at a Congress Saturday. The former president wants a peaceful and dignified exit after dominating the Angolan political landscape since 1979. For reaction regarding the smooth transfer of power in the ruling MPLA party, I reached Alcide Sakala, an opposition member of the Angolan parliament and the spokesman for the main opposition party, UNITA, in the capital, Luanda.
The most important are the challenges that the country has in terms of development, first of all, and on the second hand, in terms of national reconciliation, which is a process that did not move with Mr. dos Santos. There are some expectations. If you take into account the intentions pronounced by Mr. João Lourenço, as far as this process should be done. But from the theoretical point of view, now the most important is to transform these intentions in practical issues so that we can advance with all the challenges that the country has ahead.
Former President Eduardo dos Santos had dominated the politics of Angola since 1979. His decision to hand over total control to current President Lourenço is seen as a very significant step in the annals of Angola. As a leading parliamentarian in Angola, how are people reacting to this, even from the opposition as well?
Our point of view is that Mr. dos Santos stepping out of power forced by the historical, economical, and social circumstances of the country. His legacy is full of negative aspects such as nepotism, corruption, stealing the money of the people, all those things. I think he's stepping down as a man who has brought the country to the crisis that we are living today in the country. You know that all the money has been stolen. The country has no money yet today, which means that we have now a new beginning. If there is a political will, we can really advance on many issues we're ignoring in the past.
A lot of Angolans credit Eduardo dos Santos with transforming the country economically and ensuring that there's peace and stability. What is your take on that?
He's not succeeded by achieving an economic stability. On the other side, it was not able to take advantages of the end of the war in terms of advancing with the concretization of the ideals of national reconciliation. For instance, we still have a lot of issues that were not solved in the past. Probably we can really have a different climate in the country, which will enable Angolans to go further. And one of the examples is, for instance, the exhumation of the remains of Dr. Savimbi.
Dos Santos wanted a dignified exit, and some people are saying he has had it. He is able to do it by officially handing over in a smooth, peaceful transition to his successor, João Lourenço, who was his defense minister at the time. Don't you think that he deserves some commendation of leaving a legacy of peace and stability and a united Angola?
Well, more than that, his legacy is based upon the way he has governed the country, you know. So today, Angolans have a lot of difficulties, as you can imagine. Social, acute problems, economical collapse in the country, lack of national reconciliation. That's the legacy of the Santos. Is on the other side of the history, because he was not able to profit, as I said, the end of the war to promote all these changes. That's the way, you know, most of the Angolans, we look at him, at his legacy.
Alcide Sakala is an opposition member of the Angolan parliament and the spokesman for the main opposition party, UNITA. He spoke with me from Luanda. The Malawian Opposition United Transformation Movement, or UTM, plans to continue with its campaign Saturday in Zomba. The party was recently launched by Vice President Saulos Chilima after falling out with President Professor Atapita Mutharika. This after stating that corruption in the government has reached an embarrassing level. The Vice President has since called for an independent investigation of public institutions, but officials of the government have called on him to resign after demanding he present his evidence. For more about Saturday's campaign, I read Patricia Kaliati, a prominent member of the opposition party United Transformation Movement in Zomba.
We've been having meetings. We are launching as a new movement, the United Transformation Movement. We started in Lilongwe, the capital city of Malawi, at the Masinta ground. Then we went to Planta, we went to Zuzu, we went to Mangoshi. Then now we are going to Zomba on Saturday, and Sunday we are going to be in Mulanje. This is mobilizing people, one, to register, but also to mobilize people to follow the United Transformation Movement, where the trust and the hope of the Malawians lies. And our leader is Dr. Sausilma, the president, to become 2019. We are a issue-based campaign. We have issue-based meetings. We don't castigate, we don't waste our time talking about others. We talk about our movement. What is it that we're going to do? Issue to do with the fertilizer, which is so high that people that cannot even manage and buy.
How are Malawians reacting to your movement since you began campaigning from the capital Lilongwe into Zomba, where this campaign will continue?
My brother, Voice of America, is massive. It is massive. Those who are bitter are the ones who took themselves as if they're the only one in the country, and the ones who took Malawians for granted. But people are following the United Transformation Movement because of the policies and the manifestos, how we are articulating our issues. And when we are castigated, when we are insinuated, we don't hit back. We leave that is city politics, politics of old days, not these days. And the people now, they are tired, they are fed up, they are drinking. At the end of the day, they're giving beer to the youth, the thinking that when they do that, they're empowering them, which is really very unfortunate. But as United Transformation Movement, we are moving and we are mobilizing people and it's massive, I'm telling you, it is massive.
Political analysts in Malawi are saying that this is not the first time a movement has arisen and that such movements like UTM usually make a very big splash, but with time they fizzle out. Do you think UTM is sustainable?
That's a mistake which those people are talking about. If they are talking about the movement which they've heard or which they've seen, then this is not the one. They've got to wait and see what is that they're going to do. But when they are listening to the movement which they are talking about, my brother, they are making a mistake. This is a movement, and I'm telling you, it's a vice president of this nation who is the leader of this movement, the president, a person who can stand in the shoes, speaking the voice of the voiceless, without even fear, without even saying, I'm having vehicles, I'm having an office, I'm having what, I'm honored. No. But he came up to say, we are looking into the basic amendments of people. We need to bail out people from corruption, nepotism, tribalism, where these are contributing to the lack of development, where we cannot even share development equally because of that. Malawi cannot devolve. And we are looking into bailing Malawi, the violence which are taking place. You know, we cannot allow to defeat and to rape democracy. We've been in the country for a number of years in democracy since 1994. Since 1993-94, would like to make our democracy mature. And this is what the United Transformation Movement will be doing.
What makes the UTM special among all other political formations in Malawi?
One, the policies. Two, the one who is leading us, as Dr. Saul Chilima, who is a God-fearing person, but also he has got the passion of the people at his heart. And he is not a person who is looking for good things, because even he joined, he was asked to be the running mate when the party, the current government, was in a position. So you can say that if he was somebody else, he would have gone for the ruling party. But also not only that, apart from being government, he has opted himself to go into the United Transformation Movement, as though he was a running mate of somebody, although he was the vice president of somebody, would have looked into his package. But he said, let me look into the affairs of Malawians. So it is totally different, and he's the one who is also telling us that we should not be hitting back to whatever people be saying. We want to have a new politics. We are saying the difference is this is a new politics, not politics as usual, but politics unusual.
Patricia Kaliati is a prominent member of the Malawian Opposition United Transformation Movement. She spoke with me from Zumba. Former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe says he accepts the election victory of Emmerson Mnangagwa in the recent presidential poll. The former president had publicly backed opposition presidential candidate Nelson Chamisa from the MDC alliance in the July 30 elections, but Mnangagwa from the ruling ZANU-PF party was declared winner of the presidential vote. His remark came after Mnangagwa announced a list of cabinet ministers Friday. For reaction to Mugabe's acceptance of Mnangagwa's election victory, I read Rejoicing Gwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst in the capital, Harare.
It wasn't going to make a difference, to be honest, whether or not he'd accepted it, because we know there was hullabaloo when he declared openly that he was going to vote for Nelson Chamisa. But, you know, it's his democratic right to refuse or to accept. It's not like his acceptance will suddenly enhance the credibility of the system. But it has raised a lot of, interest as to whether or not he did it for expediency or he just wants to make sure that his pension is guaranteed, especially the security and safety of his wife and children.
But isn't he entitled to it as a former president, irrespective of whether he accepts the outcome of Emmerson Mnangagwa as the legitimately elected president of Zimbabwe or not?
Look, in ZANU-PF, it is the politics of vengeance and patronage. Do you remember that already the war veterans were rattling the Saba, saying he has caught sold out in closed court? And they were all talking about removing his name from the international airport, including excluding him from the extra list of Heroes Acre, permanent residents. So for him, he knows that his entitlement is dependent on the level and the degree of patronage. So being an old, wily, and sneaky politician, he Bill knows where he decided with the bread that is buttered.
So what happened to factions of the ZANU-PF who were opposed to MSN Mnangagwa? And there the court has upheld its election victory. What happens to them next?
Well, what we are looking at now is definitely the extinction. This is where we have the extinction level. In other words, because since the opposition hasn't won, it means that their political survival is purely dependent on the existing government. So I would say that the eulogy and the epitaph of the G40 is truly and well inscribed in the template of stone.
So what is the word on the street concerning the decision of the court to uphold MSN Mnangagwa's victory? Of course, the MDC alliance has rejected it, will not recognize him as the president. What's next?
Look, I mean, see, Zimbabweans are naturally inclined towards the law. We are law-abiding, and we tend to take a court decision very seriously. So while there was immediate ire and, trepidation after the court judgment, now we are resigned to accepting the status quo. And remember that also the new president has been talking a lot about all his branches and extending his end of reconciliation. And I would assure you that even with the announcement of the new cabinet, most Zimbabweans are now preparing themselves for the five-year tenure and they're wondering how best they can get on with their lives to make sure that they are comfortable in the next coming 5 years.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa has said that Zimbabwe is open for business. Now he's been duly confirmed by the court. Do you foresee any rush or a surge of investors or foreign direct investment in Zimbabwe anytime soon?
You want a quick answer? No. The tremor and the roots of 37 years of dictatorship are not things that you wish away. While it is possible for the international community to take him at his word, but remember that the systems and the structures of ZANU-PF, their high appetite for public expenditure and spending money that they don't have, the budget deficits, the human rights violations, all these things do not change overnight. So I believe that any sensible investor will want to see how these factors are being balanced in the new dispensation. And I feel that probably in the next coming 6 or 7 months, that is when we might start expecting some real change towards positive economic growth. But for now, the international investment sector is likely to be very cautious.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. Liberian opposition parties are calling on the government to establish a war crimes court to deal with perpetrators of the country's civil war. Their call followed a meeting with the government aimed to find ways to better work together. The opposition parties say those who committed war crimes and crimes against humanity during the civil war should not be allowed to get away with it. But ruling party officials have questioned the timing of the court. They rather say there's need for a reconciliation to unite Liberians in the face of challenges. For reaction regarding a war crimes court, I read Leonard Dodu, the front page Africa newspaper news desk chief in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
Okay, so the recent meeting was intended to foster a good working relationship between the opposition political parties and the government. The meeting presented an opportunity for opposition political parties to proffer some suggestions to government as to how the country should be governed. And one of their suggestions was that there is a need for the establishment of war crimes court. There is a need to prosecute perpetrators of Liberia's civil war. But my understanding is that this suggestion wasn't well taken by the president. He believes that there is a need to rather reconcile the country and focus on nation building instead of focusing on persecuting people who are allegedly involved in the war.
But some Liberians are saying those who were perpetrators of the war, the civil war in Liberia, should be prosecuted. And recently there has been increasing pressure from the international community, including the United Nations and the U.S., to establish this court to deal with those who were alleged to have committed war crimes during those periods. What are Liberians saying about this?
There is a mixed views amongst Liberians in terms of establishing the war crimes court. I can say for sure from my interaction with people, a lot of people are indeed in support of this court. A lot of people think that people who committed atrocities and crimes against humanity should face justice, just like the former president, Charles Taylor, is facing justice for what he did in Sierra Leone. But it takes the political will of the government to really push this, and that is what we are yet to see from the government. As a matter of fact, the political party from which the president comes from is strongly against it. They have said it openly several times that we cannot have war crimes court now. The Minister of Information has also said that Liberia should rather focus on reconciliation, nation building, instead of a war crimes court.
But I understand that some Liberians are saying Liberia has yet to prosecute those who were involved, and that it is only countries outside Liberia who have been prosecuting or arresting some of these perpetrators, like in the U.S. and recently in France. What are you hearing on the ground?
Yes, that is true. I mean, and that is where the frustration comes from, that why is it that we cannot prosecute these people? If the international community can do it, then why can't we do it? I mean, there are a lot of those who committed crimes during the war, crimes against humanity, that are still living here in Liberia. There are some who are even in position of influence. There are some in the Senate, and yet they are walking about freely. I was doing an interview with one guy, and he told me that one of his instructors at the university was the very person, or is the very person, that killed his uncle during the war. And each time that man stands in front of him in a classroom, he loses focus. I mean, these are the stories from many Liberians here for which they really want the establishment of war crimes court. But instead, we are not seeing it on the ground. We are rather seeing it happening in the international community in other countries around the world.
There has been a recent arrest of a former Liberian rebel in France who naturalized to be a Dutch national. Some Liberians in the diaspora are saying this is the time for the international community to put pressure on the government in Monrovia to act, to establish a tribunal to prosecute those who might have violated human rights and committed war crimes during the Liberian Civil War. Do you anticipate this happening, that pressure could be put on the president and his administration to rescind their decision to kick against the establishment of the tribunal or war crimes court in Liberia?
As a journalist on the ground, I have already begun seeing signs of pressure being exerted on the government for the establishment of war crimes court. A common example is the resolution from the United Nations Human Rights Committee. I mean, their wordings were so strong. They called for the implementation of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission recommendations, and some of these recommendations called for prosecuting those who were involved or believed to be involved with the war, and also banning some of them from holding public office for 30 years and above, amongst others. And there have also been other calls from international NGOs on the government to establish this court. There are pressure on the ground from local NGOs who have petitioned the national legislature to see the need for the establishment of this court. So the government right now is under a lot of pressure, and we are just looking how we are going to cope with this.
Lena Dodu is the Front Page African newspaper news desk chief. He spoke with me from Monrovia.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Kenya, along with countries in the Horn of Africa, faces a growing threat from extremist Islamist organizations, particularly the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The Center for Human Rights and Policy Studies in Nairobi has created an online platform that focuses on countering violent extremism. Mutuma Rutiri is the center's director, who also co-authored a new book, Confronting Violent Extremism in Kenya. For VOA reporter Ruben Chiama asked him about the extent of the problem of violent extremism in Kenya.
There is no underestimating the nature of the problem. And this is a major regional security challenge. It is for sure one of Kenya's major security challenges. It is also global in nature. It is rapidly changing, which makes it a problem for the state in how it responds. Remember, those involved in violent extremism are also adapting to every move the state actually makes.
Where do you see significant progress in this whole issue, countering extremism?
I think we have seen several approaches. We've seen the military approach, which one would say that by 2018, Al-Shabaab capabilities have been significantly degraded. That's a military component. But also I can see in the last 10 years, we have seen good progress in improvement of states and security force services relationship. It has taken many, many years of attempting to learn. But I would say overall, we have seen significant progress in reducing the incidence of attacks, for instance, in the cities and major urban centers. Our data shows that that has been reducing. The problem still remains, particularly in the border regions, where you have incidents. But I would say in the most other urban areas, we have seen a reduction in the incidents.
Any pressing setbacks or challenges?
The security services still have not reached the point where I would say that they have developed very good relations with the community the way they are supposed to be. And that's a challenge, because this is a problem that cannot be solved without the community being involved. There is, of course, a big problem with how to deal with returnees, individuals who have returned from Al-Shabaab. There's a policy gap in that. There is a challenge with who will take the lead. It is not clear where the interventions ought to be and what kind of interventions ought to be made to address the problem of those who have returned. We're also seeing increasing recruitment online, using technologies. The same technologies that promote openness and progress are also exploited by the terrorists. And we still don't know enough. We still don't have enough tools of countering that. And those are important areas that require attention.
And finally, Dr. Rutere, what are the key recommendations coming from your book that you have just launched?
Of course, strengthening partnerships with communities. Remember, this is a problem that affects communities, and it cannot be won without the communities themselves. So reorienting, retooling, refocusing how security services work with communities is very important. Second is to look at how do we change the communities that are affected, because beyond the individuals, there are also parents, siblings, and larger communities. They are equally affected by the problem. So we also need interventions at the community level. We need to strengthen intelligence-led security operations much more than we have at the moment. We have also made recommendations on increasing accountability in counterterrorism operations. That's always a challenge, but also equally very important in ensuring that these operations are conducted within a rule of law framework.
That was Mutuma Ruturi. He spoke with reporter Rubin Chiama from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Meanwhile, borders are more than lines on a map. They are also places for meeting and exchange and getting to know oneself better through encounters with the other side. No one knows this better than artists whose job it often is to explore boundaries of all types. That's the idea behind Translucent Borders. It's a multi-year New York University project that brings together musicians, dancers and choreographers from Ghana, Italy, Israel, Palestine, Cuba and the U.S. to improvise and perform together in each other's native land. Here's part one of viewers Adam Phillips' two-part look at the Translucent Borders.
That's the Translucent Borders team in the heat of one of the countless informal improvisation adventures they've embarked upon over the past 2 years.
At this moment, it's a time when we have to talk about what artists could give to people in terms of communication across borders and the value of borders.
And that's musician, composer, and NYU professor Andy Tierstein, the originator and director of the project.
We think of borders as a divisive marking point, but actually, artists have always been attracted to that. We've always been drawn to borders. They're magnets for us. I mean, generally speaking, artists want to see what's behind the border. What are they doing over there?
Tierstein gives improvisation pride of place in the Translucent Borders project.
Because when you improvise as a musician or as a dancer, you are actively engaged in a listening process, and it's on a very high level where you are connecting and exchanging. It's kind of like jumping into cold water. At first, you're afraid to do it, but once you get in there, then you navigate the water.
You can open your eyes and use the space.
Dege Feder, an Israeli Jew who emigrated from Ethiopia as a child, is leading a warm-up exercise for some of her fellow artists. They hail from Israel, Palestine, Southern Europe, the U.S., Cuba, and Ghana. As a dancer-choreographer who combines East African, Israeli, and modern dance styles and techniques, Feder crosses many borders in her art. Still, before she joined Translucent Borders, she'd never seen or heard a nickel harpa, a large, intricate, 16-stringed instrument related to the violin, but played with keys and dating from the Italian Renaissance. To her surprise, Tierstein chose to pair her with two nickel harpists, Marco Ambrosini from Italy and his daughter Angela, and invited her to create her own original dance from the encounter.
And when I heard the music, I said to myself, what I'm going to do with this? How I can find myself into this piece? Everything, it was different. In the beginning, I listened with my head, but after couple of times, I start to listen with my heart, with my body, and then I felt it. When you open and you learn new things, you are creating a new world in yourself. My bridge to that, it's art. Sometimes you can find very little way to create the bridge, but you need to try.
Sule Imoro, a traditional drummer and dancer from Ghana's upper northwest region, is trying, successfully it turns out, to woo an all-white, all-American audience to join him in an ancestral dance.
In Africa, we don't have a bad dancer. When you dance bad, the ground will not complain. So I tell them, come out and dance. So those people who are feeling shy not to dance, they jump on stage. I like to inspire that because me and you, we are all the same. And other people can also cross to come to Ghana and share with us.
Audience member Michelle Stoddard was one of the impromptu dancers in the audience.
I wasn't expecting, actually, with a practically torn Achilles tendon, to be up on the stage dancing, but we need some joy out of the experience of cross-cultural stuff at a time when borders are, you know, walls.
Of course, in many parts of the world, people on one side of a border shut out those on the other side. Netta Viner, an Israeli Jew, and Mohammed Maghrabi, an Israeli-Palestinian Arab, are founders of System Ali, a Jaffa-based hip-hop collective and educational nonprofit dedicated to exploring the borderlands where anger, love, community, and violence often coalesce. Viner says that in Israel-Palestine, borders are often made of barbed wire and concrete.
But the highest walls are made of fear. Fear from whoever is not you. And so a lot of what we do is to challenge these borders or challenge fear or tell our students and to tell ourselves to use music and use art as the strongest amplifier we have, not to be afraid, then to express all of our anger and rage, but also our love and responsibility for each other and for the place where we live.
So what you're saying is that on the one hand, borders can be made of fear, but on the other hand, borders also make love possible.
Definitely. It enables contact.
And contact, says Viner, can create the sparks that empower raw creativity, art, and even transcendence. Tomorrow, the artists explore some of the new borders they've discovered between each other and within themselves. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Solid Star.
Love you, love you.
Shaba, 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 shaba. Hey, hey, hey. Me love no be shaba. Be bang just in a cabin. Aha, you say make a way, girl, I go wait. So whenever you're ready, just let me know, no. You say make a way, for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no. For your love, and I feel to go down for your love. The kind of love me get for you, no be joke. Can you don't carry me go? Anywhere you enter, can you scatter? You make a man spray you in dollar. Every day I won't see that your face. I can't do without you. I won't see that your face again. No, I can't do without you. You say make a wait, girl, I wait. You're ready, just let me know, no. You say make a wait for your love, I go wait. Oh, girl. So when you're ready, just let me know, no.
Like my only flaw. Oh yeah, check it in my walk. Yeah, when I see you, I'm more confused. So, confused. I say, wait till you ask, I don't go refuse. I don't go refuse. And I go take care for you whenever you're down. I say, for you, them girls that go back. We can go get a story all over the town. Your papa, they beg, I go build down a house.
You say, make a wait.
Girl, I go wait. So, I go wait.
So, whenever you're ready, just let me know.
Zimenifikia, nipo salama, tausijali.
nalishwa vitamu vinono na jelia biriani angamia enzi twadalika na pokidali nimekusahau nakumbuka tula kojina kidogo angalau beho wa mizizi soku katashina enzi wakapanda dau mjini baba pesa fitina nimeukani thara Vicente Haba mfuko mechina nando uwezo wangu likuishia ningekupa nini tena kula yangu ya kukapasia kumeza ukatema Shamsham, mtoto kanikabiri oh, Hadi na kamkam, uminambila lufajiri Na nishambesha nyota, chochake kikubwa cha mapenzi Kanjaza kanchota, kanshika pabaya Na kutadhalisha, simu za usiku punguza Unahatarisha, penzi langu moto kunguza Nisha kusahau Nakumbuka tula kojina Kidogo angalau Beho wa mizizi soku katashina Penzi wakapanda dau Mjini baba pesa fitina Nimeukani thara Vicente Haba mfuko mechina Nando uwezo wangu likuishia Ningekupa nini tena Kula yangu ya kukapasia Kumeza ukatema
Bam, then no gets on bam. Hey, boom. moyobulam. Please, boy, me begging you, please. Imu jimu physically fit. Nobody, me only medicine. And to me, at what is that? I only babble when you tell me babble. I go low when you tell me go low. I lay low when you tell me lay low. I go down for you. I kill one for you. Kubika and kubikula. Then kubika and kubikula.
Baby, give me terrible. I love you.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you have visual problems, you don't hunt a black goat in the depth of a moonless night. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, recently announced additional assistance to support achieving the goals outlined in the Bilateral Development Objectives Assistance Agreement between the U.S. and Nigerian governments, signed in 2015. $25 million will strengthen good governance by supporting state governments' efforts to bolster Nigeria's open government partnership commitments to improve transparency and fight corruption. An additional $1.5 million will support a healthier, more educated population in targeted states through the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, also known as PEPFAR, for a total of $26.5 million in additional assistance. The additional new funding brings the total U.S. government assistance provided under the five-year Development Objectives Agreement to $1.1 billion. USAID is also working with federal and state health ministries to build stronger health systems with the aim of guaranteeing equitable access to quality health care services nationwide. USAID collaborated with Nigeria's Ministries of Budget and National Planning, Health, Agriculture, Power, and Education, as well as state-level government counterparts, to structure the Bilateral Assistance Agreement, which runs through 2020. The United States believes that as the most populous country in Africa with the largest economy on the continent, Nigeria holds tremendous influence over the future of Africa, Acting Mission Director Aaron Holleran said. USAID is committed to partnering with the government and the people of Nigeria to address its development challenges.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.